If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's Monday, and it's 12:01. It's time for your favorite program. Listen to Aunt Katie as she tells you what's wrong with the world and how to fix it. No, we're going to start. Oh, Dave, I like that. Thank you very much. Yes, gather round me, children. First up is we're going to have some joys and sorrows because we have a few things to discuss about that. And then afterwards, we're going to be interviewing a journalist named David Dayan, whose byline, I realize, is kind of ubiquitous, but he was a new find for me and a very smart man indeed. But to start with joys and sorrows, this was brought to my attention by Alicia Fowler from Chefs Collaborative. Thank you, Alicia. The FSIS, which is the Food Safety and Inspection Services part of the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, is proposing that some new rules that would permit meat producers to use terms like, quote, raised with care or, quote, humanely raised on sustainable family farms, end quote, simply by making up their own definitions for the terms. Each company's definition of humanely raised would be entirely arbitrary, and regulators would perform no inspections to verify any of their animal welfare claims. That's the end of the quote, which was in the Huffington Post. This article was in the Huffington Post on October 13th. I highly recommend taking a look at it. And there is a 60-day comment period, and you can be part of that process either by going to the Huff Post on October 13th and finding the link, or go to the regulations.gov website and look under FSIS, Food Safety and Inspection Services. It's an eye-opening idea with all the confusion around labeling in this country and how hard it is for consumers to decipher exactly what is meant by what term. The idea that we literally do not have a gold standard for sustainably raised or human, you know, is just crazy. But I have another item about this, which I'm going to tell you in just a second. The other cool thing that's happened, or rather, that was our sorrow. This is our joy. The cool thing that has happened is there is a new climate change deal. I'm sure a lot of you saw that. 200 nations are committing to reducing HFCs, which are the chemical used in air conditioning and refrigerators. It's a long, long, long timetable reaching way out into the 2030s. And let's hope that we don't immolate before then. But at least it's a beginning. Now, how you sell not using air conditioning to countries that are on the cusp of grasping it, like India, and yet it's sort of like telling them they can't eat beef. Oh, no, no, no. It's not good for the planet. So now you can't have it. That's kind of colonialism 2.0, right? Okay, next up, here's something that's, as I like to say, in the gray area. This is that McDonald's, yes, our very own McDonald's of fast food fame, is leading the pack and testing out something called a sustainable beef option. They just completed a very small pilot project in Canada with the Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. And there's one of these Roundtable for Sustainable Beefs in virtually, I'd say probably about 25 nations. And they are in the process of this pilot, and this is what relates to our first item about the FSIS and labeling. They are identifying what, quote, sustainable means in terms of cattle, and then figuring out how to score ranchers and packers on how they measure up to that, whatever that elusive term is going to be. To learn more about the criteria that governs, quote, sustainability in the cattle industry, you need to visit the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. The Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. Now, this was started by McDonald's, by JBS, Cargill, you know, some of the really, really big major players in the cattle industry. This is their sort of version of greenwashing. I mean, it probably does contain some forward-thinking ideas. Certainly deforestation is all over their website. So it's clear that they know what they are doing wrong, because you can see that on their announced goals. But the problem is that the way beef production is practiced right now by the big players, the JBS, the Cargill, the Tysons, you would have to literally completely revamp the industry to get rid of the problems that make it unsustainable. Still, if they addressed fair wages, for example, instead of the near slave wage that they deploy now, and also, you know, a little bit of pollution mitigation, a little bit of help to those farmers, those feedlot owners, like to help deal with the endless river of shit and piss. I mean, these guys really have it tough, and the big packers do not pay for that. The farmers and ranchers are in charge of taking care of that, or the guy who owns the feedlot. So, you know, I know it's hard to feel sorry for them, but really that is a major issue, is disposal of waste, animal waste. It's why the aggregated intensive confinement is simply not an option and has to be dismantled in ways which I am not smart enough to have figured out yet, but somebody will, I'm sure. I just wanted to mention that, speaking of good things, Tom Philpott, one of my favorite guests here who writes for Mother Jones, and you should all be following him on a daily basis. He's incredibly prolific and so smart. Tom reports that Tyson has just acquired 5% interest in Beyond Meat, a company that produces vegetarian burgers that, quote, bleed like real meat. Woohoo! Makes sense, right? Meatless burgers, non-dairy products are generating nearly $5 billion in sales now. And who better to make fake meat than meat companies? I, for one, am hoping these substitutes really catch on and that more of the big companies do start to shift away from peak meat production as we have it now. And last on my agenda, and I always make this segment way too long, and then I have to speed it up, and then nobody can hear or understand what I'm saying, but I'm going to try to be calm here. And that is that Bob Dylan, I'm sure you've heard this, but Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and I could not be more delighted. I think of him as sort of the poet laureate of every man. I grew up with his tunes. He's an amazing songwriter. He's like a Woody Guthrie. Anyway, I was delighted. I know other people thought it was maybe not so great, but who cares what they think. So let us now take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with David Dayan, a journalist who writes about economics and finance. He'll be talking with me about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and a little-known clause within that that we should all be paying attention to. So stay tuned.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
Okay, we're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I think I might have even forgotten to announce that before. I was so excited about starting the program. But yes, that is the name of the program, What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. And my name is Katie Kiefer. And this is the Heritage Radio Network. And today we are going to talk with David Dayan about TPP and a clause within TPP that should have everybody somewhat alarmed. It's called the ISDS, or the Investor State dispute settlement. But to go back to David for a second, David is a journalist who writes about economics and finance. He is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, which came out, I think, just this past spring. He is the winner of the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. He is a contributing writer to The Intercept and a weekly columnist for The Fiscal Times and The New Republic. He also writes for The American Prospect, Vice, The Huffington Post, and many more. He lives in Los Angeles. And thank you so much for joining me on the program today, David. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Now that I've discovered you, I see your byline everywhere. But no, I was just delighted to read up on TPP. A Trans-Pacific Partnership is something that, you know, I think is kind of heaving its last gasp, but it still bears talking about only because it was a template for a trade deal that really had people's milk hot on all sides of the equator. Can you and you wrote a lot of pieces about TPP and specifically about the investor-state dispute settlement, ISDS. What got you so interested in this?
Well, coming out of the 2014 election, which was a fairly historic sweep for Republicans and gave them high watermarks not seen since the early 1930s in Congress and all around state houses across America, it was clear that in this last 2 years of the Obama administration, their belief was that the only thing they could get legislatively to salvage anything would be on trade agreements. That was their game plan since the day that they lost in 2014. Eventually, they went through and got the fast track legislation passed, and that enables a process whereby trade agreements that are negotiated by the president and the U.S. Trade Representative's office can come back to Congress and go through an expedited process without filibusters, without possibility for amendment, that just an up or down vote in both legislatures, both houses of Congress. And so this, you know, the fact that they got that passed, and then they followed that up by completing the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, just seemed like that would be the fertile ground by which the Obama administration would try to sort of put a cap on their legacy. And so that made it interesting to me to see what was in these agreements and what is what was the purpose of doing more trade agreements with countries, you know, half of which in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we already have bilateral trade agreements with. So
yeah.
What was the need here? What was the desire? Tariffs are already pretty low. There had to be some other motive for pushing forward a deal like this, and that led to my exploration.
Very interesting. So tell us a little bit about this investor-state dispute settlement, because I just finished writing a book about the meat industry, and that's where I heard about that mechanism and was duly horrified. So can you just tell the listeners, you know, what actually does that mean? It's been around for a long time, but it seems to be expanding. So, go ahead.
Yes, it's been around since trade agreements, I think, in the 1960s. And basically, it is the mechanism by which disputes within trade agreements can be adjudicated. The initial theory was that if you do a trade agreement with a developing country and you induce investors from your country to go over there and invest in a foreign country, and a problem arises. Their factory is taken over by the state, or they... you know, their goods are expropriated in some way. The investors felt like they wouldn't get a fair shake from that country's government, and from that country's judicial system in particular, if they were to dispute the fact that their factory was taken over. So they put in this mechanism whereby it would take it out of the judicial process of that country and put it in the hands of a third party, nominally independent tribunal, where these foreign investors could appeal to if they had this situation arise, and they could say, look, this foreign government took over our factory, and we need to be compensated for that. So that was the idea behind it. The problem is that through both drift in the trade agreement process and also through just successive rulings and interpretations in these ISDS tribunals, the ISDS process, which stands for Investor State Dispute Settlement, has expanded, as you alluded to. And now it's that if a law changes within a foreign country, investors can say, well, that law is causing me to a reduction in my profits that I expected when I made this investment, and you need to compensate me for that loss. There are all sorts of ways in which this is manifested. And now we have ISDS in hundreds of these bilateral agreements. Mm. Most of the time it was, you know, developed countries and developing countries that were involved in these agreements together. NAFTA was sort of the first time that you had a developed country doing a trade agreement with another developed country that had an ISDS piece in it.
Uh-huh.
So you had the U.S. and Canada engaged in this agreement, and then Canadian companies, which are more mature, could sue the United States in these extrajudicial tribunals for the loss of expected future profits, with tribunalists who are corporate lawyers picked in a process whereby they could be working on an ISDS case one day and then sitting in judgment of an ISDS case the next day.
Oh, so, that's beautiful.
And TPP would expand this even further.
Wow.
Because you have several developed countries involved, Australia,
yeah.
Japan. You could have subsidiaries of Chinese companies who happen to be in Malaysia or Vietnam with this newfound ability. It would double the amount of countries that could, the amount of companies with foreign investments in the United States that would have the possibility to appeal to this tribunal.
Let me stop you for one second. Who are they extracting the money from? Like, you can't. Right. Are you suing? Is it so? Say
you are
a company.
Suing a country.
You're suing the country. Okay, I just wanted people to really understand that. Exactly.
A country. It could be the local government. It could be the state government.
Right.
Or it could be the federal government. And the only award that can be given in a investor state dispute settlement process is monetary.
Uh-huh.
There is no sort of other penalty that can be given out in this case. And so the monetary penalty needs to be paid by that government through their government treasury, whether it's at the local level or at the national level.
What if they say they don't want to pay?
Well, there are mechanisms within. These rulings have the effect of the rulings of the highest court in the land.
Thank you. Okay.
And so there are mechanisms involved whereby, you're involved in a trade agreement with this other country, and then this foreign investor sues you successfully to extract money from you. There are, whether it's the WTO or these international organizations that will demand payment to make the system work, or that country can say, you need to give this investor who won this dispute settlement process their award, or we're going to have something to say about it. So it's I would say more. You know, you always do hear the theory, I think Andrew Jackson said about the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court made a ruling, now let them try to enforce it.
Right.
Like, you and what army? But in this case, given the international system, there really are teeth to ISDS rules.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wanted to get at that because, I think everybody thinks, well, if Smithfield, now owned by WH Group,
right.
Decided that our new pollution laws in North Carolina, they don't exist, but I'm making this up as a hypothetical, was a barrier to trade, could they then sue the American government for lost revenue? And I think you're saying the answer is absolutely
they can. Yes. One of the more famous ones that's happening right now is around the Keystone XL pipeline. President Obama decided to reject. Well, TransCanada, which is the company that was going to install that pipeline, has sued the United States under the ISDS process using NAFTA, which is a Canada-U.S. agreement, for $15 billion in lost expected future profits from the Keystone XL pipeline.
Jesus.
And that's just an example of how, what the effect is of this. And the fact that this was a case against the United States is significant because traditionally what we've seen, although the ISDS process has grown massively, especially the last 10 years, we've seen more ISDS cases than in the entire timeline up to that point.
Wow.
You know, most of them have been structured around weaker countries that, you know, change their laws for whatever reason, and then there's a pile on by these foreign investors. Whether you see it in Greece or Spain or Argentina is actually the country that has seen the most ISDS cases against it. Argentina has had this fiscal crisis for the last decade.
Right.
And so, you know, that they've been perceived as a weak country. But here's a case where TransCanada is trying to, the United States certainly would not be seen internationally as a weak country.
Right.
But, you know, this would be a precedent-setting ruling if you get a developed country to be forced into this. We have seen that in the past with Germany around its changes in nuclear power laws in Germany. They were sued under the ISDS process. It's actually triggered a lot of opposition within Germany to trade agreements that would include ISDS, such as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is the U.S.-European Union trade deal.
The TTIP,
separately being negotiated right now. Germany is on the verge of pulling out of that specifically over ISDS.
Oh, no kidding. How interesting. Yeah. So there are ways in which, there were so many questions about this. That was that American Prospect piece was really excellent, I have to say.
Oh, thank
it really
you.
Helped me a lot in understanding these issues. In that piece, you mentioned that the so-called non-tariff barrier became a euphemism for ordinary health, safety, environmental, and financial regulations that U.S. corporations wanted to weaken both at home and abroad. How does fit into the ISDS, or is that just a completely separate issue around negotiating trade deals?
The enforcement mechanism. So
these
trade deals are no longer really about trade.
Mm-hmm.
They are about smoothing and harmonizing regulations to sort of guarantee profits for foreign investors. They are about, you know, putting limits on the types of regulation you can engage in. And then if you as a country who signed that agreement try to go beyond that, then the ISDS mechanism is sort of the enforcement, saying, hey, you signed this agreement. You said that you weren't going to disrupt nuclear power, or you weren't going to disrupt this regulation around health and food safety, and you did, and now we're going to sue you for billions and billions of dollars. And even though the change in law is not a remedy under ISDS, frequently what happens is the country says, okay, we will repeal that law, and then the ISDS case gets withdrawn. So it's, you know, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office tries to say, well, no laws can be changed through the ISDS process. And while that's true to a certain extent, practically, in reality, that's what happens, and we've seen that in a similar process in the United States around dolphin-safe tuna labeling. This was a case where this didn't go through the ISDS process, but actually went through the government of Canada and Mexico, who said that under NAFTA, these regulations that were put in place by the United States were biasing and discriminating against Canadian and Mexican fishers, and you know, disrupting their ability to make a profit. And they went through the WTO, and the WTO said, yes, this is discriminatory. And they said, you know, you're going to have to come up with sanctions. I believe there were $2 billion in sanctions. And what the U.S. Congress promptly did was put forward legislation that passed the House to repeal the dolphin safe tuna labeling because it represented now a financial risk to the U.S. Treasury. And that is what happens. That is a textbook example of what ends up transpiring when a country or a company sues to change a law. They're suing, nominally for money, but really what they want is that law to be repealed, and eventually that's what they get.
Well, this is what exactly the playbook by which country of origin labeling was lost.
Same thing.
I mean, they threatened fines through the WTO, but ultimately they would have evoked the ISDS if the Congress had
That's
backed
the
down.
Resort, exactly.
Right.
I mean, TransCanada probably, in the Keystone XL case, they probably thought, well, the government of Canada is maybe won't go to bat for us here, so we'll just do it ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And the difference is that, the same thing. They don't have to go through the U.S. court system to set up any kind of ruling that they were in fact discriminated against or that they were in fact expropriated from. All they have to do is convince this group of corporate lawyers that sit on this tribunal that that was the case, and they can win that case.
Right.
And that's why this is becoming increasingly, and this was the subject of a Huffington Post article I wrote about.
Yeah.
Increasingly, the landscape by which financiers decide to bankroll these companies, these foreign investors engaging in these lawsuits,
right,
and do it in such a way that they get paid on the back end if they succeed. They're using this ISDS process as a money-making mechanism rather than what it was initially designed for, which was an investor protection mechanism.
Right, right. Oh, no, I thought that was fascinating. I mean, if there's more to say about that, let's because basically you were saying that they bundle together, or what will happen is that a third-party investor will say, oh, wow, I see a risk to you here. I will absorb the costs of bringing this litigation through the ISDS mechanism,
right,
and then If it pays out, then I get a chunk of that change. Is that how it works?
That's absolutely right. That's exactly how it works. And there are entire firms known
wow.
as litigation finance firms that pour through legislation in these foreign countries
mm-hmm.
and find ways in which companies could make ISDS claims, and then they bring them to these companies as a package deal. Here's the rule that has been changed that you could argue.
Uh-huh.
Here are the lawyers that you can use in that case. Here are the tribunalists who you could suggest to sit on that tribunal.
No way.
It's a 3-judge panel, and one of them gets chosen by the company. One of them typically gets chosen by the country, and then they decide on the other one. So these litigation finance firms are bringing this huge package deal. Here's the law. Here are the lawyers. Here are the judges.
Yeah.
And here's all you have to do. We'll pay for it.
Right.
So it won't cost your corporate treasury anything. And we reap the rewards on the back end. And this is a fast growing part of this ISDS system. And I think it accounts for at least some of the rise in ISDS cases over the last 10 years.
Oh, indisputably. I mean, I don't see how it could not be part of that program. Let's talk for a minute, though. When a company successfully sues and invokes ISDS, then obviously the country at fault with the changing rules or whatever has to pony up a big chunk of change.
Right.
And that chunk of change comes out of, as you said earlier, the National Treasury, the Federal Treasury.
Right.
So in other words, these are taxpayers. Right. The taxpayer is footing the bill for this.
Ultimately, taxpayers are bearing the cost, and this is really a problem because if you look at what ISDS really is, it's insurance.
Yeah.
It's saying that I am a foreign investor and I have certain risks that I am taking on by investing in this foreign country, and the ISDS process is my protection against that risk. So I can sue if events change and conspire against me, and I can and recoup my investment and what I expected to get out of it. The insurance industry is well equipped to handle the protection of that risk.
Uh-huh.
And the difference would be instead of taxpayers in that country being on the hook for any costs borne by that system, it would be privately administered through the insurance industry through the imposition of premiums And if the ISDS, or not the ISDS, if the foreign investor runs into a problem, he could trigger his insurance policy, and the insurance company would have to pay out rather than the taxpayers of a country having to pay out. There is no reason why anything in the ISDS system couldn't be handled by an insurance policy.
Well, no reason except for greed, essentially. I mean, because
It's easier,
It's much better to have a taxpayer pay.
Taxpayers on the hook than to put private interests on the hook. There's
Oh my God.
No question about it.
Absolutely.
And that is why you're seeing this turned into a game for profit. That's why you're seeing the both third-party finance, and you're also seeing hedge funds and private equity firms buy up companies that they think will have an ISDS claim in the future solely for the purpose to, you know, initiate that claim and reap rewards from it. And we have many examples of this in Spain when solar subsidies were being phased out. Years after the subsidies phase out began, hedge funds bought solar companies and then sued under ISDS. You see a similar situation in Dominican Republic and many countries around the world where, you know, you're buying a company not because of its ability to produce goods and services, but you're buying it so it can sue the government. I mean, that's the sole reason.
Wow. It's literally breathtaking. I must say you put it out really well there, David. I mean, wowee. So when I think, when I read this stuff, you know, like your articles and some of the other things I've read about ISDS and just sort of how trade deals are structured in total secret, I mean, like really secretive. Well, I don't know why that is, but it all makes me feel like there is this giant capitalist overlord that has essentially done away with boundaries and national, you know, interests and is really just going for the, you know, governing the world economy through mechanisms like this. I mean,
there's no question that there's a framework that has been set up, this sort of international framework for the smooth traveling of capital across national borders and the protection of that capital through extrajudicial processes. And that's really what the modern trade regime and trade consensus has looked like. And what we've seen over the past couple years is that that consensus has begun to break down. And you can add Brexit to this. You can add, obviously, the disarray in which the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was expected to sort of sail through, has fallen into with opposition from all the major party candidates for president. This consensus is starting to wind down, in part because of the attention being paid to mechanisms like ISDS, where corporations can sue governments, and things like that. The fact that people are starting to understand that these trade agreements aren't about trade and they aren't about creating jobs, but they're about, you know, guaranteeing profits for large multinational corporations that need to site their headquarters and factories in wherever is cheapest for them. That has started to become part of the conversation. And I think this is an important moment, you know, to see where the future of our you know, this consensus and this international system will go. People are getting, you know, more educated on this issue, and the more they see of it, the less they like of it.
I mean, for this particular moment in the election cycle, it's you know, it's profitable for both Republicans and Democrats to repudiate these trade deals, but I don't see that that there's any pending legislation or suggestions on the part of Congress. And please correct me if I'm wrong. That would suggest that some of these, I mean, as we talked about at the top of the hour, the TPP expanded ISDS. Right. And so even though they might be paying lip service right now to how bad these deals are, and oh no, it's, you know, shipping more jobs overseas, they don't give a shit about that. I mean,
well, we'll see. I mean, you know, the idea that the Obama administration has is that they will let all these hot passions go, and then in the lame duck session during the holidays when no one's paying attention, they'll quietly pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership and push it through. I don't know that they actually have the ability to do that, that they have the votes to do that.
Right.
I think that what, you know, Trump has done to turn a typically very supportive party in terms of trade against deals like this has been very significant. The individuals in Congress still have to think about their next election, even though the lame duck session is a time of the least possible accountability for things like this.
Yeah.
But, you know, you even look at Hillary Clinton's book in 2014, before she even announced as a candidate, she showed in that book reservations particularly with ISDS.
Uh-huh.
And so there is a possibility here to redefine globalization, to redefine the nature of these trade agreements in a way that makes sense for the workers in this country, mm-hmm. and moves forward that way. There's actually been a paper written by Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch, who is probably the most knowledgeable person on this in the country, from a progressive perspective, and Jared Bernstein, who was Vice President Biden's economic advisor,
sure.
In the first term of the Clinton the Obama administration, and they've put together this progressive view on trade and what it would need to do to actually be, you know, something where we don't disengage from the world,
sure.
but we also do it in such a way that would be beneficial to our workers,
yeah.
And beneficial to the rights of labor, the rights of the environment, and things of that nature. This is a really important document because it brings forth these strands from the progressive left and also from, you know, the policymaking mm-hmm. engine. And someone like a Bernstein to get involved in this, you're sort of bringing together these different parts of the Democratic coalition to build this possibility for the future. So I would like to see that get out there and pick up some traction, because the truth is that something is going to have to happen. I don't believe that the votes are there on TPP. And a Clinton administration is going to sort of have to go back to the drawing board and figure out if they want to continue to push these deals, how they're going to do it. And, this paper could offer a way forward.
Well, I hope so. And I certainly will look it up and read it with interest. It's a little bit off of my topic. But still, I mean, I'm really interested in trade. But my research into sort of how companies, you know, race to the bottom in terms of, going to the cheapest place, why we've outsourced all these jobs, obviously, is because we can get cheaper labor elsewhere. There are less environmental regulations and so forth. Unless trade agreements begin to sort of level some of that playing field, I don't see that they're ever going to really amount to much more than just corporate greed grabs.
Right. I would tell you another area, and this is particularly true in agriculture, which mm-hmm. I know you're interested in, is to use the laws that we've had on the books for the last century around antitrust.
Oh, yeah.
This is a growing field of interest, mm-hmm. I think, on the Democratic side.
Definitely.
It's certainly the case that with respect to agriculture, you have these large firms that squeeze their producers into, the tournament system for chicken and things like that.
Absolutely.
This is very important in terms of taking it. It's not just the ways in which producers are getting squeezed. It's really taking away their economic liberty. There was a time when a poultry producer or a beef producer would have the freedom to go to market and get the proper price for the goods that they were selling. And now that, because of the intermediary position of big agriculture, has been totally taken away.
That's right.
And it's very disempowering, and it's very, you know, troublesome in this.
The monopolization. I mean, you've taken away every access to any other producer.
And it's more than just economically, because obviously it has an economic impact, but there's a sort of cultural impact to this, right? And so, you know, using the Sherman Act to break up these big agriculture monopolies, using it for, you know, the big monopolies that we see in the airline industry or the cable industry or all, I mean, you name a sector and it's pretty heavily concentrated now. If we had a Justice Department, Antitrust Division, and a Federal Trade Commission that actually engaged on these issues and injected competition back into our system of the economy, you could see some really wide-ranging changes.
Oh, I agree.
And we know because we've seen it. Like during the New Deal, this was part of the system that was set up that led to broad-based prosperity for 40 years. And then when Reagan got in, the rules by which antitrust policy went through were completely changed. And we've seen massive market concentration over the last 30 years. And
most
so
definitely.
I think the ways in which those two play together, antitrust and trade, because when a corporation is allowed to get this big, suddenly not only do they have, obviously, more economic power, but they also have more political power.
Oh, yeah.
And they use that political power to get their way. And one of the ways they do that is they guarantee their ability to go abroad and make profits and sort of abandon this country in terms of its workers, in terms of its tax base and things like that. So they do play together.
Yes, absolutely. Very well said. I hope you'll be writing an article about that soon.
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure.
Thank you for the assignment, Deb. Yeah. I've written extensively on antitrust. So,
send me some links because I'd love to talk to you more about this at the next time. I think for now we should probably wrap it up. But I hope you'll be a regular guest, David. This is your wonderful speaker, very clear and understandable, even for a non-financial mind like my own. And certainly you've connected some dots that I think otherwise people would not necessarily connect. So I thank you so much for joining me. This is the point where you get to promote yourself shamelessly.
Okay.
And so if you have a website, if you have a blog,
I'm happy to do that.
Do it.
So as you mentioned earlier, I did have a book that came out in May, and it was about the foreclosure crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So not exactly what we were talking about, but certainly an important issue. It's called Chain of Title, as you said, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And if you go on Amazon or wherever you buy books, you can find Chain of Title. As you mentioned, I have a newsletter that I send out through email that gives you links to all the stories I do. So I write it a few different places. You don't want to just constantly have to check those over and over again. I send you the links two times a week to the stories that I've written. And the way to get on that is through tinyletter.com, that's all one word, tinyletter.com/DavidDayen, DavidDayen.
Excellent.
And you'll get signed up to the newsletter, and that goes out Wednesdays and Fridays, and you get the links to everything that I do. I'm also on Twitter, and I'm usually sending my links out right when they're published. And that is at twitter.com/DDAYEN. That's my handle, at DDAYEN.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll be Twittering out this particular link in a very short order.
Great.
And I hope you'll do the same. And I want to thank my sponsor, which is New York State Grants and What am I saying? New York State grown and certified seal, thanks to my sponsor. David, thank you very much for joining me today.
Okay, Katie, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
It really was an interesting talk, and we'll be having one again soon. I'll be signing up for your newsletter, and I hope everybody else will too. And we'll see you next week, folks, with another great show. You know, Aunt Katie giving you the real deal on how we eat and where it comes from. See you next week. Have a good week, folks. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Yeah.